We're going to be in Exodus 20, starting in verse 8. Hear the word of the Lord. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant, or your livestock, or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. This is the word of God. Please have a seat.
Good morning. I know you are all well aware today is Valentine's Day, but you may not be aware that you are free to celebrate this holiday or not. Now, if you have a significant other, I'm not speaking for them, but I mean, it's your life, right? You're free to do what you want. No one controls your calendar. Biblically speaking, whether you are a hopeless romantic and you want to go all in, or you are the cynic who wants to resist the commercialization of love, you're free to either engage or to refrain from engaging in Valentine's Day. Listen to what the Apostle Paul says, not specifically about Valentine's Day, about esteeming certain days. In Romans 14, verses 5 through 8, he says, "One person esteems one day as better than another, while another esteems all days alike. Each one should be fully convinced in his own mind. The one who observes the day observes it in honor of the Lord." And in verse 7, he says, "For none of us lives to himself, and none of us dies to himself. For if we live, we live to the Lord. And if we die, we die to the Lord. So then, whether we live or whether we die, we are the Lord's." I hope you can see from that that whatever we do with certain days, we should be doing it to the Lord. And I hope you also see from that I engaged in a bit of overspeak earlier, when I said that you are free, it's your life, you can do what you want and no one controls your calendar. That's not exactly true, is it? I mean, from one perspective, maybe. But ultimately and more fundamentally, that's not true. If you are a believer in Jesus Christ, you do not belong to yourself, you belong to Him. Whether we die or whether we live or whether we die, we are the Lord. That is, we belong to Him. You have been bought with a price. And your calendar, your schedule, your time, your energy, your body, your agenda, your plans, your life belongs to Him. And if you are not a Christian and you are here today, that doesn't mean that you belong to yourself either, though. Because you see, God made you. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Psalm 24:1. God owns what He makes as He rules over everything that He has made as the sovereign King and Judge. We all belong to God, and our lives should show it. But this isn't exactly naturally how we think or how we live, is it? I mean, naturally, we tend towards want to be free and want to be independent. We tend to think that our agenda and our plans are the most important. We ought to live as God has made us. That is, what we ought to do as those made by God and in the image of God and made for God, we ought to live oriented on Him, where our focus is Him, where we see Him as the center of the universe and we revolve around Him. I was playing a video game with my boys the other night. I was quite not good. So they were trying to show me how to do it. It's a game called Rocket League, where you are these vehicles on this big, massive field, and it's like soccer, but you ram the ball with your car and try to hit it into the other person's goal. And then the ball blows up. So it's nothing like soccer, but anyway. So I'm really not good, and they're trying to tell me, hey, you gotta do this. Make sure you do this. So they said, hit the Y button, and you'll get ball cam. That's where you can always see where the big soccer ball is, no matter where you're at. So regardless of my location, regardless of my direction, one time I was upside down in the other person's goal. I don't know what I was doing, but I could always see the ball. And it's not just that I could see the ball, but I realized that my existence in the game was about that ball. Like, that's where I was focused. The same is true with Christ. That he should be our orientating focus. That no matter where we are at or what we are doing, we are in relationship to him. We should be directing our lives and focusing ourselves on him, living a Christ-focused life. And I think that what ends up happening is that when life seems so messed up and we are disoriented, it's when we're not focused on him, because he is our orientating focus. The nearly constant tension in this world exists, I think, because of the nearly constant efforts by nearly everyone, nearly all the time, that they each have their own agenda, and everybody's agenda conflicts with everybody else's, because what's our agenda? Everything and everyone should be oriented on me. Do you want to know why there's conflict? It's because you have two different agendas. If you say, I should be the center of my universe, and they say the same thing, and they say the same thing, and they say the same thing, then a lot of conflict, right? And God is saying that there will never be order, there will never be peace, there will always be chaos and tension until what is restored is everyone is oriented and focused on me. The Ten Commandments, where you're at today, and the Fourth Commandment, what we are on this morning. The Israelites belong to God, both because they were made by him and for him, but also because God had entered into this special relationship with him. He said, there's going to be a covenant. This is a special promise, an oath, that I'm going to be your God, you will be my people, and this is how we will relate to each other. I will promise to be faithful, to bless you when you keep my covenant conditions. And if you are not faithful to keep the covenant conditions, then I will be faithful to bring judgment upon you. And he gave them a summary of these covenant conditions in what we call the Ten Commandments. And so we read of the Fourth Commandment, which all the commandments are intended to do, is to orient the people of Israel on God. Exodus chapter 20, verse 8. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant, your livestock or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Put most simply, we would say that the Fourth Commandment is about the Israelites suspending their regular work and routine on Saturday, the seventh day of the week, to make it special, sacred to the Lord their God, because he rested on the seventh day from his work of creation. The Sabbath day was a day of fasting of sorts. It was a day of fasting from their ordinary work and routine so as to reorient themselves on God by renewing their covenant faithfulness to God and their faith in God. I'm going to say that again. Listen, the Sabbath day was about them reorienting themselves on Yahweh by renewing their covenant faithfulness to him, like recommitting, and they're renewing their faith in him. It happened every week. The Fourth Commandment was a call for the people of Israel to rest from, to cease from, to put a stop to any self-reliance, any self-governance, any self-focus that they had been engaging in throughout the week. Saying that shouldn't be the case. Let me reset you. Okay, let's reorient on this seventh day. So the principle of the Fourth Commandment is simply that everyone should orient their lives on God with faithfulness and faith. That everyone should orient themselves on God by engaging with faithfulness in and faith in the Lord. Let me show you how I got there. Look at verse 11. Exodus chapter 20, verse 11. It says, for in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth. When he says for there, he's saying because. Here's the commandment to keep the Sabbath day, the Fourth Commandment to cease from your work on the Sabbath. Why? Let me tell you, because I made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and then on the seventh day I rested. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. He's grounding both the principle, that is the idea behind the commandment, he's grounding the principle and the precept of the fourth commandment in his person and in his ways. He's saying, because of who I am and how I live, how I am, therefore you should keep this Sabbath. Well, what does he do? Well, he rested on the seventh day. That's kind of weird to us, and it should be, because this is adjusted language. Okay, this is the Bible's way of God's way of being gracious to us by taking the spiritual, the divine realities of the infinite God and trying to fit them into our finite, small human minds, categories that we can understand, that says God rested. Okay? He's painting a picture for us. And I think we can get this picture more clearly if we go back to where this began. Genesis chapter 2. First book of the Bible, the second chapter, Genesis 2, verses 1 through 3. This is what verse 11 of the fourth commandment is pointing us back to. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished. Note that word. The heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God finished, there it is again, he finished his work that he had done. And he rested on the Sabbath, on the seventh day, from all his work that he had done. Do you see? He's not resting from weariness. He's resting from his work, specifically his creative work. So when it says he rested on the seventh day, it just means that he stopped doing that kind of work. And he rested on the seventh day from all the work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it God rested from all his work that he had done in creation. Do you see? Three times it says the work he had done, that he had done. It's all done. Twice it says it was finished. It was finished. In the chapter 1, verse 31, it says, and God saw everything that he had made. It's all made. And behold, it was very good. It's all finished. It's complete. This helps us to understand a little bit about what he's saying when he says that he rested on the seventh day. It's saying that after God finished creating the world, he stood back and he sat down on his throne. This was the enthronement of God's sovereign control over all that he had made. The chaos had been controlled and subdued. Harmony and peace were put in order under his rule. You see, if you look at Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, it says that the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. It wasn't as it should be. It was an empty kind of mess. And God said, here's all the materials, now watch me make order and bring peace out of it. And when he did, he brought restoration and harmony to the world. So then he could then say, it is finished, it is very good, and he could sit and rule over it. So after his creating work, God didn't stop his providential, his sustaining, his blessing, his ruling work. No, after his creating work, he began all this other work. Do you see? The reformer John Calvin has said something to the effect of, this world is created by God to be the theater in which God displays his glory. I think that's exactly right. What God was doing in creation was setting the stage. He was building his theater. Then he would invite and bring in all of his image bearers so that he would display his glory to them and then through them. And so when he was done with creation, he began ruling over it. Isaiah 45:18 says, for thus says the Lord who created the heavens, he is God. He who formed the earth and made it, he established it, and he did not create it empty. That goes back to Genesis 1:2. He formed it to be inhabited by us. I am the Lord, and there is no other. It seems to be a strange phrase at the end of a verse about his creation, except for when you understand that when he created the world, it would be so that he could be the Lord over it, blessing and ruling it. And so the precept of the fourth commandment and the principle of the fourth commandment are founded on and flow out of the person of God, who he is. Specifically, we could say that the person of the fourth commandment is God being the sovereign creator, the sovereign sustainer, the sovereign ruler, and the sovereign restorer of all things. He's the sovereign creator because he made everything that is. He's the sovereign sustainer because he sustains and preserves all life. He's the sovereign ruler because he both has the authority and the power to rule over everything. And he is the sovereign restorer, because just as he brought order and restoration and peace and harmony to that earth that was formless and void, it was just darkness, so too, after the fall of Adam and Eve in the garden and sin and the curse entered, he is the one who will bring restoration in the new creation one day. He is the only one who will bring restoration. So all of this means that God is the center of the universe. I'm not saying that he should be. I'm not even saying that we want him to be. I'm saying that that is the case. In fact, he is the center of the universe. And so, therefore, we should live that way. That's the purpose of the fourth commandment, you see. God rested from his creation so that he would sovereignly sustain and rule and bless his creation. And since his rest is one where he has complete and sovereign, absolute, total control over all things for the good of his people, then the engaging in this fourth commandment, then, engaging in this kind of rest, is a way of acknowledging he is on his throne, that we are to submit to him and be faithful to him, and we are to trust him in our faith. So the foundation, you see, of the fourth commandment is that because God rested, that is, he created the world, he stood back and sat on his throne to rule over it, therefore we need to live that way and acknowledge that to be the case. So the Israelites were being called to cease, as I said, from any self-reliance, any self-governance, any self-rule and self-importance and self-focus. And they were to turn to submit themselves to trust in, to focus their lives on God, to orient themselves on the Lord with faithfulness and faith. This is what life is about. This is how we're supposed to live all day, every day, worshiping him, who indeed is the center of all things. Look at verse 10, Exodus 20, verse 10. After he says, 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, he says, but on the seventh day, that is a Sabbath to the Lord. Not just a Sabbath for your good, though that is the case. That's not primarily the focus. The focus here is that it is a Sabbath to the Lord. It should be an act of worship. They should be spending this day as a way of worshiping him. First and foremost, all of the commandments, including the fourth, is to be about worshiping the sovereign God. But how does one do that? How is the supreme ruler and the sovereign Lord over all the universe, how could he be worshiped by us? Well, the ancient Near East gods, the false gods of the peoples around them, they thought, well, how we worship them is by meeting one of their needs somehow. Maybe they need a shelter. We'll build them a temple or a shrine. Maybe they need clothing, some kind of beautiful arrangement that they feel better about in this human world, so we'll give them that. Or maybe we'll give them some food of some kind that would be really pleasing to them, or we'll give them some gold or something, or we'll do some act that will somehow make them feel good towards us, favorable towards us, and they'll bless us. It was really manipulation in the way they were thinking. But they called it worship of these gods. And Yahweh steps in and says, you will not worship me that way, because I'm not like them. The Apostle Paul goes to the people of Athens in Acts 17, and he says, you worship all these gods with all these statues. He says, but let me point out the God you don't even know, the God you should be worshiping, the only one. In verse 24, 25, he says, the God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands, as though he needed anything. Since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. The Lord, you see, was not calling Israel to work for him, but to cease from working so that he would work for them, that he would bless them. That's because God is not worshipped when we try to meet his needs. He has none. He is worshipped when we trust in him to meet our needs. Say, yeah, but didn't God also command the Israelites to build the temple for him and to offer sacrifices to him? Indeed, for many, many reasons. None of those reasons were because he needed that. He makes this abundantly clear in Psalm 50, verses 12 through 15. God says, if I were hungry, which he cannot be, I would not tell you, for the world and all its fullness is mine. Like, what are you going to give me that I don't already have? Do I eat the flesh of bulls or drink the blood of goats? Of course not. Then what's the point of offering sacrifices to God? He says, offer to God a sacrifice of thanksgiving. Do you see? You're not to try to meet God's needs, but to be thankful to Him because He meets yours. Offer to God a sacrifice of thanksgiving and perform your vows to the Most High. That is, have His covenant faithfulness to Him. And then call upon me in the day of trouble. Call upon me because you trust me. Your faith is in me to take care of you. I will deliver you, and that is how you shall glorify me. And do not get that reversed. We call upon Him. He delivers us, and that's how we glorify Him. So this means also that not only do we worship God when we don't try to meet His needs, but when we don't rely completely on ourselves to meet our needs. We too often tend to trust in ourselves and to try to orient all of life around and on ourselves. In Exodus chapter 16, we have like one of the first mentions of the Sabbath rest, of ceasing from work. It's during the time when they're in the wilderness and they have like no food around, and so they need to be provided for by God by sending manna from heaven. And He says, every day you go out and you'll gather this manna so you can eat, but only gather as much as you need. If you take more than that, it's going to rot. I will ensure that. Just take enough every day that you need. But He says on the sixth day, gather double. Because on the seventh day, there will not be any manna on the ground. You're going to need to trust me that I know that every day of the week, any leftovers you have rots and it's spoiled and ruined and you will have no more to eat. But on the seventh day, there will be none. And what is left over from the sixth night, that'll be there. What is He doing? He's teaching them to rely on Him. He's not saying that, hey, on the seventh day, I'll take care of you. The rest of the week, it's on you. The point is that every good gift and every perfect gift has come from Him. He's been providing for them all week. This is just an intensified way of showing that to them, of helping them to renew their faith in and their faithfulness to Him, or reorienting themselves on Him. It is foolish, you see, foolish to live life like we exist by our own strength and unto our own agendas and for our own glory. Living the self-focused life is unfitting for those who are made in God's image. Living the self-focused life is unfitting for those redeemed by God's grace and who bear God's name and who are created for God's glory. We are not the center. He is. So the Israelites needed the Sabbath day every week so that they would not only be reminded, but they would be reoriented on Him so they could renew their faithfulness to and their faith in Him. The Sabbath was meant to remind them about and to aid them in or reorienting themselves by saying, I won't trust in myself. I'll trust in you. It's not about my plans and my schedule, my calendar, my agenda. All my days belong to you, Lord. And it did this by forcing them to look away from themselves to God. It did this by forcing them to look up from their work to His work. It did this. The Sabbath day was a way of saying, listen, are you mine or not? Do you trust me to take care of you or not? Will you submit to me or not? And every week it was a covenant renewal of their faithfulness to God and their faith in Him, to look to Him, submitting to His sovereign rule and trusting in His sovereign mercy. Because they had to say, you, God, are a sovereign creator and sustainer and ruler and restorer of all things. You may have noticed here that I'm talking about them, the Israelites. That's what they had to do. Now it's true, right, that all of us, that actually all people should be orienting themselves on the Lord. It's true that all people should be trusting and being faithful to and submitting to God and God alone. But the specific commandment here, the precept of the fourth commandment, that was for Israel. The precept of the fourth commandment was a sign of the old covenant. It was a sign of the old covenant. You can turn here or listen from Exodus chapter 31, verses 12 through 17. I'm just going to look at two verses, 13 and 16. God says, you are to speak to the people of Israel and say, above all, you shall keep my Sabbath. For this is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I, the Lord, sanctify you. Two other times in the Old Testament, we see this language of, and only two other times, a sign between me and you. And it's one with the covenant of God made with Noah and the rainbow. He said, will be a sign between me and the earth. The second time was with Abraham, and he said, the sign of circumcision, this will be a sign between me and you, that I will bless you and all the world through you. Here we have the third time. This is in the old covenant with Moses. Look down to verse 16 of Exodus 31. Therefore, the people of Israel shall keep the Sabbath, observing the Sabbath throughout their generations as a covenant forever. They're keeping the Sabbath day as the covenant. That doesn't mean that's the only covenant condition, the only covenant command. It just means that this was the sign of the covenant. It is a sign forever between me and the people of Israel. This is how they kept my covenant in a distinct way. Or listen to Ezekiel 20, verses 19 and 20. God says, I am the Lord your God. Walk in my statutes and be careful to obey my rules and keep my Sabbaths holy, that they may be a sign between me and you, that you may know that I am the Lord your God. Notice, he didn't just say that I am God, but that I am Yahweh, your God. We go back to Exodus 20, verse 10. The seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. To Yahweh, your covenant God. You are my covenant people. So the Sabbath here was of the fourth commandment was a specific precept for the Israelites in the old covenant. It was a way of them keeping the Sabbath, was a way of them giving a sign that they belonged to the Lord. It was a way of their sign that they would be faithful to the covenant of God. That they would submit themselves, their calendar, their time, their energy, their livelihood, submit it to Him and entrust it to Him. So two really important truths flow out of this reality that the Sabbath was an old covenant sign. Number one, because it was an old covenant sign, and since a new covenant in Christ has come, and we are no longer in the old covenant, we are no longer bound to this Sabbath precept. We are bound to the Sabbath principle of orienting our lives and reorienting our lives around on God and renewing our faithfulness to and our faith in the Lord, yes. But the specific command of resting from work on the seventh day, that was for Israelites in the old covenant. Not for Christians in the new. The second really important truth that flows out of this is that because the Sabbath was an old covenant sign, it was a shadow of new covenant realities. Because it was an old covenant sign, it was a shadow of the new covenant substance, namely of Jesus himself. The Apostle Paul says in Colossians 2, verses 16 through 17, therefore, let no one pass judgment on you in questions of food and drink or with regard to a festival or a new moon, or a Sabbath. These are a shadow of the things to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. Think about what a shadow does, right? If you see a shadow, you know, you don't just look and start talking to the shadow, unless you're in Peter Pan, right? You know that that means there's an object there making the shadow. It's pointing to, it's reflecting something real, the substance. So if the Sabbath is a shadow, the substance is Jesus. It's showing us and telling us something about, pointing us to the Christ. So the question is, in what ways is Jesus the substance for which the Sabbath was a shadow? In what ways was the Sabbath pointing to Jesus? In what ways is Jesus the fulfillment of the meaning of the Sabbath? I'll give you three ways. Number one, Jesus promises sovereign care. His sovereign care for the people in the new covenant. Those who are in the new covenant, by faith in him, he promises to sovereignly care for them. You see, that's what happened in the old covenant when they were obeying the Sabbath command. They would not work. They would not go out and gather all their food. They would do what? They would entrust themselves to the sovereign care of God. They would say, God, you are the sovereign creator and sustainer and ruler and restorer of all things. We will submit to you, be faithful to you, and put our faith in you that you would sovereignly care for us. And Jesus says, I'll do that for my people in the new covenant. The second way that Jesus is the substance of the Sabbath shadow is that he promises salvation rest. Salvation rest for people in the new covenant by faith. In Matthew 11, Jesus says, come to me. Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Well, rest from what? Laden, that's burdened down with what? What are you weighed down with? Not just physical tired, being physically tired, it's a spiritual weariness. Being carrying the burden of your sin and the guilt of your sin, he says, come to me and I will give you rest from that. I will take that heavy weight and put it on my back so that you will be light and free. You will be at rest in my salvation. He says that you need rest from thinking that you can and trying to earn your way into God's good grace or into heaven, into forgiveness. He says, that's unbearable. It's too much. You can't do it. Jesus says, but I can, and I did. So come to me, and I will give you rest. Rest in my obedience. Rest in my sinlessness. Rest in my perfection. Rest in my sacrifice and my substitutionary death on the cross in your place, and you will have salvation rest. The third way that Jesus fulfills the meaning of the Sabbath is by promising a secured hope for all those in the new covenant by faith in Jesus. A secured hope. The Sabbath, we read in Exodus 20, verse 11, pointed back to creation, right? It pointed back, for in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, and then he rested on the seventh day. It pointed back to the creation work of peace and order that God brought in 6 days. But more importantly, when we read in Exodus chapter 20, verses 8 through 11, that's not only after creation, it's also after decreation started. In the Garden of Eden, when Adam and Eve sinned, the world started falling apart. Paul says it in Romans 8, that the world is groaning. It's groaning for something. For what? To be born again. It's groaning for a new creation. Sin is destruction, it's chaos, it's disorder, it's being disoriented because it's not focused on the Lord. And so the Sabbath, you see, command of Exodus 20, of the fourth commandment, not only points back to creation, but it points forward to the new creation promise, to the new creation work that God does in Jesus, that God brings about in the cross and the resurrection of Jesus. First, making us new creations, it says in 1 Corinthians, in Christ, by faith. And that he's still working this newly creative work in us, making us, creating in us to be more like Jesus all the time by his intercessory work as he reigns on high now. And one day, Jesus will work to bring about the fullness of the new creation. Forever and ever and ever, the fullness of new creation upon his return. Wherein he will bring order and peace out of the chaos of this sin-filled world. One day, in the new creation, our hope is that heaven and earth will be one. That there will be no more sin or suffering. There will be no more strife. There will be no more chaos or disharmony. There will be a perfect shalom, a perfect peace between God and man, between all human beings and all of creation. That everything and everyone will be perfectly oriented on Jesus Christ. And faithfulness will not just be by a small few now and again, but by everybody all the time. That's our hope, and Jesus secured it by his life, his death, and his resurrection. So what do we do with this? How do we respond? How do we obey the fourth commandment knowing that the precept has been done away with because it's been fulfilled in Jesus, and yet that the principle still is abiding for everyone, that we should be orienting ourselves on Jesus, renewing our faithfulness to him and our faith in him? How do we obey this commandment? Listen, without diminishing the fact that Jesus is the substance of the shadow of the Sabbath. Without diminishing in any way that Jesus is the fulfillment of the fourth commandment and the Sabbath command. I think simply put, we live a Christ-focused life. I titled this message, The Christ-Focused Life, because that's how it should be. Our faithfulness is to Jesus Christ. We're to say that Jesus is Lord. Our faith is to be centered on Jesus Christ and who He is and what He has done and what He's doing and what He has promised to do. The Apostle Paul in Colossians chapter 1, verses 15 through 20 makes it beautifully clear, I think, that Jesus should be the conscious focus of our faithfulness and our faith, that we should be orienting our lives around Him because Jesus is the sovereign creator, sustainer, ruler, and restorer of all things. Listen to this. Speaking of Jesus, it says, He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation, for by Him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through Him and for Him. Do you see how He is the sovereign creator? And everything has been made not only through Him, but for Him. So everything should be oriented on Him. Look at verse 17. And He is before all things, and in Him all things hold together. He is a sovereign sustainer of all things. Because not just, He doesn't just hold all things together. They hold together in Him as the focus. Verse 18. And He is the head of the body, the church. And He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything He might be preeminent, for in Him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell. He is the sovereign ruler over all things, possessing all power and all authority. He is the supreme one that everyone should be focused on, submitting to Him and trusting in Him. And verse 20, and through Him to reconcile to Himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace. That is bringing order and harmony out of the chaos by the blood of His cross. Jesus is the sovereign restorer of all things. In Him, in Himself, and all that He has done and all that He's going to do. We should live the Christ-focused life, trusting in His sovereign care for us, enjoying His salvation rest, longing expectantly for His hope that He has secured for us. Living by submission to and faith focused on Him, orienting our lives on Him with faithfulness to Him and faith in Him. How do we do that practically? What's one way, I want to give you just one way that we can be about renewing our faithfulness to Christ and renewing our faith in Him? It's doing what we're doing right here, right now. Observing the Lord's Day. Now let me be clear. The Lord's Day is not the Sabbath. The Lord's Day is not the Christian Sabbath. It's not as though we look at the fourth commandment and say, oh, we need to be obeying the Sabbath commandment just on Sunday. That's not the case. There is not a direct replacement from Sunday to Saturday. The Lord's Day is different in that the Sabbath was meant for the people to cease from their work, their ordinary routine. But the Lord's Day, so called because it's the day upon which Jesus rose from the dead, that day is a day where we gather together to focus on Him and to worship Him, to renew our faithfulness in Him and our faith in Him. So although the Lord's Day is not a direct replacement of the Sabbath, there is a very real connection. Because it is still true that one day of the week is set aside to where we would glorify God differently and uniquely other than we do every other day of the week. The Lord's Day is still a day that we can and that we should be observing so as to reorient ourselves on Jesus and to renew our faithfulness to Him and renew our faith in Him. Practically and actively and regularly, the New Testament church was pursuing to renew their faithfulness and their faith in Jesus by gathering on the first day of the week, the Lord's Day. And I love this, that what is the resurrection of Christ? It's if the Lord's Day is about His resurrection, what did Colossians 1 say? It says that He is the firstborn from the dead. Well, what does that mean? It means that He is the first fruits of the new creation. It's coming, and He is the guarantee of it. Just like He rose again from the dead to rise above all the ills and evils of this world, one day so will we. He is the down payment and the guarantee of it in that sense that He is the inauguration of the new creation. And so we come together to celebrate that Jesus Christ not only died for us, but He rose again for us to promise and secure the new creation. That's our hope. We look longingly and with great excitement and anticipation for that day because he's risen from the dead. There is no other time, there is no other day given in our weekly rhythm that we can gather in such an intense way. We should always be trying to orient ourselves on Jesus. Every day, all day, we should be seeking to renew our faithfulness to him and our faith in him. But there is no day like Sunday, the Lord's day, to do that. Lest someone say, okay, but the fourth commandment was that they had to. I mean, some were put to death for not obeying the Sabbath. And you're saying that that is no longer in effect for today. Correct. And you read earlier that Romans 14 says that some esteem all days alike, some esteem one day is better than another. Correct. But be careful. Because, remember, you do not belong to you. Your calendar is not your own. And there is a command in Hebrews chapter 10 that we are to not forsake meeting together. That is a command. And so you see, it's not just something that the early church did. They gathered on Sunday. It's something that they wanted to do. It's something they were supposed to do. It's something they knew they needed to do. Do you know you need it? You need it. I need to be reminded that I am not my own. I need to be encouraged to trust in the sovereign care of the Lord Jesus. I need to be encouraged to rejoice in my salvation rest in Jesus. I need to be encouraged to look with excitement, anticipation, and great confidence that he is going to return and usher in the new creation. And I need to be exhorted. I need to be admonished and warned. I need to be rebuked and corrected about the fact that my life is not oriented always on Jesus like it should be. Do you need that? Do you need to be exhorted to renew your faithfulness to Jesus Christ? Recommit again and again and again that he's worthy of it. Do you need to be exhorted to renew your faith in Jesus? Oh, you can trust him. And 'tis so sweet to do so. That's what the Lord's Day gatherings are about. And on the Lord's Day, there's one thing that is really sweet that we get to do. On the Lord's Day, we celebrate the Lord's Supper. This Lord's Supper, the communion meal, is a new covenant renewal meal. Jesus says, this is the body and blood of the new covenant. For those who are in the new covenant by faith. So this morning, if you are not trusting in Jesus, then this communion meal is not yet for you. Instead of partaking of it, put it on the ground or hold it in your hands and reflect on what it means that Jesus died and rose again for sinners like us, like you. And then come and talk to me afterwards, or another pastor or another Christian around you, or put it on a connection card and put it in the offering box in the back, or email us at prcpastors@pineyridgechurch.org. And please, we would love to share with you more about what it means to trust in and to love and to worship Jesus. But if you are trusting in Jesus, and you've had your faith affirmed by other Christians in baptism, and you can take your communion cup and take out the wafer that represents the broken body of Jesus for sinners like us. Take it, renewing your faithfulness to and your faith in him. The same way, take the cup of juice that represents the blood of Jesus poured out for our sin. And take it with renewing your faithfulness to and your faith in the Lord Jesus.